Second half of We the People Radio. Let's see, today is June 29th. Can you believe it? June 29th, 2025 already. And my name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
So, let's hurry back. Hurry back to our guest today, Claire Lopez. And very timely. Right before the news, everything she was talking about was actually in the news break, which was kind of funny. But we learned a lot more from Claire than we did from the news break. So I really would encourage you to check back on our website at wethepeopleradio.us. Click back later this afternoon or anytime after that, and you'll find the archive posted. It's commercial-free, free to listen to, free to send. It's just an MP3 file, and we make that available along with Claire's bio and all the shows we've done with her prior, and some books that she has been part of. I didn't include that before. See No Sharia, Countering Violent Extremism. I like it. It's got the three monkeys. The FBI has its eyes covered, DHS has its ears covered, and the State Department has its mouth covered. She co-wrote that with Frank Gaffney. And then Secure Freedom Strategy, A Plan for Victory Over the Global Jihad Movement by the Tiger Team. And I just, I don't know, can't say this strongly enough. There's a lot of information out there about all this, but so much of it is either incomplete or wrong that it's really worth getting informed. And then when you hear stuff, it'll make more sense to you. So,
yeah. So we were talking about
back to where we were,
the possibilities of what could happen over there, Claire. You know, we look at several different scenarios that could happen, and fairly soon over there. What's your prediction? Revolution, regime change, military takeover? What do you think the possibilities are?
You know, I really don't know at this point. It looks like the regime has enough internal cohesion, ability to retain control over the people at this point. The fact that the United States and Israel just quit the field of battle in the middle of the operation left the Iranian people high and dry, abandoned again to the mercies of this brutal regime. I do think eventually, yes, this regime is going to go down. But how and when exactly that might happen, so hard to say. And I'm not even ready to make any kind of predictions at this point in time, but you were right to mention before, Bill, that there's a very harsh crackdown going on right now.
Yeah, and a lot of times those crackdowns kind of backfire on regimes. Is there, you know, I kind of feel that Iran was on their knees. I mean, they were defenseless when Israel and the U.S. pulled out. I mean, they could have had their way with them, and they were having their way with them. What was the options for the U.S.? I mean, we didn't want to get involved in another war over there. Should they have just let Israel continue to pound on them until they collapsed?
Well, there were a whole bunch more targets left to hit. You know, nobody ever actually considered getting into a war. Striking a certain number of discrete targets in the nuclear weapons program and ballistic missile program is not the same thing as a war,
no.
Which was never contemplated by Israel or the United States. During Israel's, you know, Operation Rising Lion, they concentrated on the nuclear weapons sites, Natanz and Fardo and Isfahan. And as we said, some of the leadership of the guardians of the regime, if you will, and also the nuclear weapons scientists. But in taking out the ballistic missile sites, and especially the launchers, the missiles themselves, but the launchers more importantly, the Israelis understandably focused on those furthest to the west. Iran's a big country. But by focusing on the ballistic missile facilities, launchers, and so forth, in the western part of the country, they destroyed the Iranian regime's ability to use Iran's ballistic missiles from there to reach Israel, which they had been doing. So that stopped that. They had no more ability to launch from the east. From the western part of the country, and actually be able to hit Israel. But to the eastern part of the country, whole bunch more sites, that were never, as far as I know, never touched, and could have been. I think probably would have been, should have been, had the operation been allowed to go on. But I think probably the U.S. kind of twisted Israel's arm and said, we want to stop this now, and we want to go do some deals. And that's where we're at the moment, with all of these targets left to be struck. We don't know, and indeed, the Director General Rafael Grossi of the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, has said publicly he does not know where close to 900 pounds or over 400 kilograms of highly enriched uranium is. I mean, I cannot imagine. I'd be very surprised if the Iranian regime had not already secreted away highly enriched uranium. I personally think they also have weapons-grade uranium and warheads. Secreted them away in some other place. Iran, as folks may know, is a very mountainous country with various different mountain ranges. And there were other places in the country, big mountains, inside of mountains, where things could be hidden. Now, I don't know, and I get the impression the U.S. intelligence community really doesn't know much either, but the Israelis will know. The Mossad will know, because their network is still there, or at least, some of it is still there. That network will identify where the missing uranium went, if it went, and what other sites are doing what. Are they still able? Did they move centrifuges? Did they install centrifuges in other places? This location that some people are mentioning called Pickaxe Mountain. Did they put stuff in there? Again, I would be tremendously surprised if the Iranians had not thought about this well in advance and already prepared backup sites that were not in the news, were not in the IAEA reporting, were not necessarily even known to the Mossad or anybody else. I'd be surprised if they had not already moved centrifuges and enriched uranium at whatever levels, 20, 60, 90, and warheads, which, they were already working on, we know that, to the new secret place or places. But I'd be very surprised.
But how do they, they say it's missing. Well, I'm sure there's a...
Because they don't know where it is.
Well, I'm sure they don't know where a lot of it is that's buried 1,000 feet underground in that rubble. How do they know it's not still down there?
Well, because previously they had a good view of what was inside there. The IAEA, inside of at least those places like Natanz, Fardo, and Isfahan, where enriched uranium, was kept and was worked on.
And they had access to that?
They had access to a certain extent. They had cameras. They had monitoring devices that sniffed radioactive particles, that sort of thing.
Okay.
But they have lost track of that, partly because the Iranians destroyed the cameras, destroyed the monitoring equipment long before these attacks. So, they don't know. We don't know where a whole bunch of enriched uranium is, was, or went to. Is it possible it was all destroyed under Fardo? Maybe, but I think highly unlikely.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I mean,
they're
is
not
it,
dummies.
Is it likely that Mossad is sharing that with our folks, or would that be?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, they would share. They do share, as I understand it, everything they receive. I also know that the NCRI shares everything they get with both the U.S. and Israel and the IAEA. So there is sharing of this intelligence all the way around. And we don't, in the public, we don't have access to all of that. We know what has been reported openly in the IAEA reports. We know what the NCRI has, you know, publicly shared in the five open press conferences that it has held since last December 2024. But we don't know what we don't know. And there is very likely a good deal of classified information to which we have no access.
So it's kind of like anybody's game right now?
Well, there's, like I said, a lot we do not know. And again, knowing the Iranians and how they operate, I would be very surprised if they had not already taken steps long before these two operations of the Israelis and of ours to go after the well-known, I mean, the names of Isfahan and Natanz and Fordo on everybody's lips. Everybody knew about them. Everybody was talking about them. Would you leave your most valuable stuff inside there, knowing how publicly these places were known? No, of course not. I think it's very likely that they moved stuff, or simply not even moved, but just installed from the get-go, centrifuges and equipment and, you know, metallurgical milling equipment to shape, to form the enriched uranium, the weapons-grade uranium, into the hemispheres that are put together to make a warhead, mm-hmm. that they had not already moved or installed and or installed all of that in other place or places, you know, way before the attacks. I mean, of course that's what they would have done.
Now, if they right now, they have satellite images of excavators and dump trucks and so forth at those sites cleaning up, and my guess is they're probably digging stuff out, trying to see what's left.
Yes.
Do you think they'll allow them to go back in there and rebuild all that, or do you think they'll be swift and just take it out again?
I think that both Israel and President Trump, you know, have said that if they make any moves to reestablish, to repair, reconstitute their nuclear weapons program, and President Trump has said this very explicitly, he will not hesitate to strike again.
Mm-hmm. Which you pretty much have to. I mean, you've gone down this road this far. You can't let them go back and start this process all over again. And I would imagine if they do figure out where this other stuff is, they'll probably go after that as well.
I would think so, yes. The question is how quickly, do any other places exist, first of all? Because I'm not saying they do. I'm saying I would be surprised if they don't.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, first of all, do they exist? Where are they? What's being done in them? You know, how advanced are the nuclear weapons programs, you know, being carried out in those places? You know, an awful lot of intelligence remains to be discovered. But once or if, when such places are discovered, then Israel will have no choice. It's existential for them, obviously. And President Trump himself has also been, you know, very definitive. He will not hesitate to strike again.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that allowed them to be this state sponsor of terror throughout the world was their ability to move resources to their allies. How badly is their money flow situation been hit, or has it been, and are they still able to supply the Houthis and Hamas and these other organizations with money and resources to continue to fight?
I think that money flow has been very severely curtailed, if not shut off. The means to even have the funds to continue to supply Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, not functioning right now.
Mm-hmm. Have we cut off
their ability
to move oil?
Not completely, but that has to happen as well. And again, that's why you'll hear discussions about striking the oil facilities, but that's not happened yet. In part, I think not happened yet because we, the United States, maybe Israel too, others, don't want to deprive a successor regime, this, I should say successor government in Iran, should that, you know, succeed in taking the place of the current regime.
That's true. We leave them with nothing to start with.
To be left without any means of support or, mm-hmm. you know, financing industry. But in the meantime, you know, the sanctions that the United States and the United Nations imposed upon Iran, but were never effectively enforced under the Biden administration, and indeed actual waivers were granted instead, those sanctions have to be enforced. And I think that under President Trump they are and will be. And that especially goes for China, which imports something like 25 or 30% of its energy needs, particularly in oil, from Iran. And that mostly travels by ship, sometimes what they call these ghost ships. There's a trans-shipment of the contents of one ship to another tanker on the high seas someplace. You know, that's all got to shut down. But, I mean, even in the meantime, you know, are the Iranians able to maintain their own oil and natural gas industries? No. Their key places like Harg Island or Bandar Abbas have not been struck. Probably will not be. There was talk briefly, ever so briefly, that the Iranians themselves, their majlis, the parliament, actually voted in favor of shutting down the Strait of Hormuz, you know, this narrow passageway between Iran between Iran and the Arabian Peninsula, Bab el-Mandeb on the other side. But there was a vote in the Majlis to shut down the Strait of Hormuz, and that talk kind of went away pretty quickly. That vote in the Majlis would have had to have been approved and supported by the Governor's Council or the Guardians Council, and also then finally by the Supreme Leader himself, Ali Khamenei, and that just didn't happen, probably in large measure because the Chinese squawked. Maybe others did too. So that doesn't seem to be happening right now. But, you know, what is the ability of the remainder of this Iranian regime, to maintain its energy production shipment? Not real clear right now, but certainly damaged, certainly degraded, or the transfer of funds, as you asked there, Bill. And even before this, you know, the Iranian people, heading into the brutal summers, you know, the heat over there is unbelievable. We think we're having it bad, which we are, but they're having it much worse. Electricity was in short supply for the population of Iran. They were also in short supply of water because of the total corruption and mismanagement of the regime, and also the shipment of their oil supplies and, you know, gas, natural gas supplies, especially over to Iraq, out of the country, which did not benefit the people. And when the money came back, which, again, the Biden administration allowed them to be paid, that money, you know, just as you were hinting at there, Bill, went to their proxies, Hezbollah, Hamas, Houthis, the Hashdashabi Shiite militias in Iraq, and did not benefit the people. As we said before, there's about 90 million population in Iran, and something like 80% of them live below the poverty line. That's the Iranian poverty line, not the American poverty line, you know, with Cheetos and chips on the couch in front of a 52-square-inch, you know, flat screen. No. The Iranian poverty line, 80% under it.
Wow.
So
let's take a really quick break, and I kind of want to know more about that. How they're, I guess it's pretty easy to subjugate people if you keep them poor. And anyway, we'll get back into that with Claire when we get back. Her name is Claire Lopez. Today is June 29th, 2025. Archive will be up this afternoon. You can find it at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Wanted to give you a little weather report. I looked it up during the break. And in Tehran right now, it's 89 degrees with 14% humidity. And in Redding, California, where we are currently residing, it is 101 with 22% humidity. So we might...
Well, we've been up in the 90s here in Northern Virginia near Washington, D.C. for the last couple of weeks.
Yes. Having grown up back there, when you're talking 90 on the East Coast, you're looking at what, 80% humidity, 85?
Humidity.
Yeah, lots of humidity.
It's awful.
I do remember just sweating, just, you know, you're sweating in the shower. You just get out and you can't even...
Practically. Not quite, but practically.
Don't bother using the towel. There's no point. Yeah. In a house with no air conditioning, you might as well just... Yeah.
Oh, that's what we grew up in.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yes. How well I remember. No air in school, no air in church, no air anywhere, which was actually probably good, because if we would have had to go in and out of the air conditioning, it would have probably seemed worse, and we were kids, so what do we know? But yeah, I'm well past that. But yes, it is 101 today here.
Wow.
So if you're hankering for the surface of the sun, just come on over and give us some time. He said it's 12 a.m. over there. Yeah, you know what? That's what I was... Thanks, David. I was looking at that. I'm like, I wonder what time it is over there. So, at night, 89. That's actually not weird for here either. Scary. Well, the good news is we're not wearing black tablecloths, so that's kind of a bonus. So with all of the stuff that we're seeing on all of this, do you think we're being kind of told the truth? I mean, what's with the leak and all that? We kind of skipped over that part. I think any of that was...
What's with the what again?
You know, the leak. You know, supposedly we didn't destroy their stuff. Do you think that was a...
That was just some preliminary report from DIA that was not final and was not reached with high confidence. I mean, forget all that. That was just noise.
Yeah, that was just noise, right?
That was just noise. But the thing is that what's called the BDA, Battle Damage Assessment, that's still going on, and it will go on for a while yet, till we get real, you know, a final readout from, you know, IAEA, for example, or David Albright's group, which we call the Good ISIS. You've heard this before, right?
No.
Because David Albright, former IAEA inspector himself, formed this think tank group and named it the Institute for Science and International Security. And the acronym for that, unfortunately, is ISIS, right? So we always call it the Good ISIS.
Okay.
Anyway, we'll get the readouts from the IAEA, the Good ISIS, U.S. and Israel. But we shouldn't be expecting that immediately. It's going to take a while. And, you know, we shouldn't be jumping to conclusions or necessarily swallowing what might be rushed out to print in any of the media.
Yeah. Well, that's always the danger. And then, you know, they make hay with that. Oh, the president didn't do what he said. He, you know, he has to declare war. What about all that? What's your, I mean...
Well, he didn't need to declare war, number one, because we weren't going to war. And, you know, a number of targeted strikes against Iran's nuclear weapons, ballistic missile, hit the nuclear weapons facilities. That's not war. Besides which, you know, can you imagine what would have happened if President Trump had briefed members of Congress to include the Democrats? It would have been on the front pages of the New York Times before you could say go.
Yeah, before it happened.
Yeah. Yeah, and presidents don't typically do that anyway. I mean, you don't...
Well, there was no need to. And constitutionally, there was no need to. As commander-in-chief, you know, in the Constitution, Article 2 gives the president, he is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. And there are so many prior examples of prior, earlier Democratic Party presidents who conducted all kinds of strikes against all kinds of places without going to Congress for permission first. But in this case, there was no requirement to do so in any case, but that it would have been foolish to allow this information in the hands of Democrats who would have, you know, run immediately to their favorite media outlets to leak it.
Yeah. Well, for all the people who think that this didn't have anything to do with us and we should have just sat back and left it all alone and stayed out of the whole thing, what's your take on that?
Well, when a regime takes power in a jihad revolution, immediately begins screaming from the heights of the new power, death to America and death to Israel, our number one top friend, partner, ally in the entire Middle East, and then immediately seizes hostages from our American embassy in Tehran and holds them for 444 days until President Reagan gets elected and is in front of the Capitol about to take the oath of office, and the hostages are released. When that regime attacks our embassy in Beirut, our Marine Corps barracks in Beirut, by the way, under the Quds Force proxy, Imad Mughniyeh of Hezbollah, who later went on to play a role along with the Quds Force and Iran in 9/11, they hit our embassy, they hit our Marine Corps barracks, how many hundreds of casualties. And then I could list a whole bunch more, but eventually they get to 9/11 itself, and the Iranians, this Iranian regime, orchestrated, directed, and executed the attacks of 9/11, where, by the way, now a democratically elected a candidate for mayor of the city of New York, Zohran Mamdani, has been elected in the primary, the Democrat Party primary, for the candidate in the final mayoral elections to come, who is himself not just a communist and a Marxist, but a Twelver, an adherent of the 12th Imam, just like the regime in Tehran. And we know this because in a November 29 Twitter post, Mamdani wrote that he was a follower of the Ithnashara, that means the Twelvers. So all of that, put that all together, and I think that regime is gunning for us. They sent IRGC hit squads to the United States to try to kill former President Trump and during his 2024 presidential campaign, and targeted our former National Security Advisor John Bolton, and targeted our former CIA director and then also Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and others. Has threatened the United States repeatedly and explicitly, and was building missiles. They already have got, and we know because they fired them, short range, medium range, and long-range ballistic missiles. We know they have all of those because they fired all of them at Israel and other places. But they were working on and close to being able to obtain and develop and field intercontinental ballistic missiles, which then could reach all the way to the United States. The missiles they have right now can reach to Israel, parts of Europe, and parts of Russia. But intercontinental ballistic missiles that they were well on their way to getting would then, in their intention, be able to reach all the way to the United States, and in their intention also would be tipped with nuclear warheads. So, yeah, they were kind of a threat to us, too.
It always kills me when these guys are like, we should just stay out of it. It had nothing to do with us. Like, really? Based on, what are you looking at again? I don't know. It's sad. They're probably the same people who think that they could go over there and, you know, roll a pride parade and just be fine. I guess it's
Well, you know, here's another point that we could make right here, and that is that according to the Islamic Shiite 12er eschatology, that is, followers of the 12th Imam, this regime and its top people, as I said before, across the clergy, across the judiciary, across the military, they believe not only that the 12th Imam is the Mahdi, the messianic figure of all of Islam, but they give him that specific identity of the 12th Imam, not only are just going to, like the Sunnis, wait for him to return whenever he, the Mahdi messianic figure, decides it's time to return, but under the 12er eschatology, this regime and its leadership firmly believe they can hasten the return of the 12th Imam, the Mahdi, for them, to earth, to usher in the end times, the day of judgment, and they do that by instigating Armageddon on earth, and that's going to bring back the Mahdi maybe sooner than he otherwise might have decided to come back, and they are willing, they're absolutely willing to instigate Armageddon, and in the words, I'll quote Ayatollah Khomeini before he died, he said, "Let this land burn, I say, let this land go up in smoke, so long as Islam is triumphant in the rest of the world." This is how these people think. We can't let a regime like that, people like that, get the most, you know, dangerous weapons on the face of the earth, a nuclear weapons capability.
Yeah, not to put too fine a point on it. That's a huge consideration, and I don't think it's one we make enough. We always, I don't know. Seems like we always soft sell it. Let's take a really
quick... Because they don't know these things. Well, I will bet you dollars to donuts that nobody has ever briefed what I just told you to President Trump and his inner tough circle. Dollars to donuts. They don't know this.
Oh, that's a good point. And the general public... pretty much doesn't
either. Well, worse yet. I mean, Mike on the street, Mike on the campus, no way. They don't know.
Well, they're not. You know, the funny part is, there are a million examples we could point to, but the funny part is that my favorite one is that they were going to do their No Kings protest on July 4th.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, how ironic. We're already 14th, celebrating,
right?
That.
It was Flag Day. It was June 14th.
Right. But the second one, they have targeted for July 4th, and it's like, really? No Kings on July 4th? Isn't that why we celebrate July 4th? Yeah.
Kind of.
Really?
I'm sure they don't know that, or, you know, who King George was, or
right.
Probably never read the Declaration of Independence, or why we declared independence from King
right.
George in Britain back way then.
Yeah, it's just, kind of sad. And I don't know. I don't know that it's any better around the world, but I got to tell you, it's getting kind of bad here. Let's take our last really quick break. We'll come right back. Our guest is Claire Lopez. And Claire, when we come back, if you don't mind, do the elevator version of what you just did, the part that the president needs to hear and that the public needs to hear, because I just don't think we can reiterate that enough. Let's hit that one more time when we come back.
Okay.
You are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Okay. Claire, if you wouldn't mind, can you reiterate your elevator speech that you're wishing that the president heard and that the public was told?
Yeah, sure. Here's what I would really like President Trump and his top senior circle of advisors, what I would hope for them to understand about this regime in Tehran and why it is different from every other adversarial regime we face or have faced, including the Soviet Union, currently Russia, the Chinese Communist Party, Kim Jong-un in North Korea. The reason this regime in Tehran is different is because it's ideologically motivated. They are true, believing, faithful, obedient Muslims, and they are Shiites, followers of the 12th Imam. And what that means is that they believe, unlike the Sunnis, which are bad enough, but this regime in Tehran are what we call 12ers. And that's because they believe that the 12th Imam, that would be the 12th in a line of Imams, father, son, down from Muhammad, as they believe, who was a little boy in the 900s, ninth century, I should say, and fell down a well and died, leaving no heir. And the Shiites were hard put to decide, what can we do? What can we do? No heirs, no successor. And they decided he's not really dead. He's just down there in the well. But actually he's an occultation and he's all around us. They believe this, okay? I know this sounds wacko. They believe this. And that he, the 12th Imam, will be the Mahdi, the messianic figure of Islam, who returns at the end of times to usher in the day of judgment, kill the pig, break the cross. This is what they believe. Break the cross means kill any remaining Christians, kill the pig, the same for the Jews.
Oh.
They believe that the Mahdi will come back and do this by ushering in the end times and day of judgment, and that their Mahdi is the 12th Imam, and that they can not only just await his return to earth and follow his commandments obediently until then, but they believe that they can hasten his return to earth. They can make him come back sooner than he otherwise might have by instigating, literally, Armageddon on earth. And with enough chaos and strife and warfare, Armageddon on earth, the Mahdi, the 12th Imam for them, will be compelled to come back and set it all straight, and thereby usher in the thousand years of Islamic rule on earth. And that eschatology, that belief, that ideology, you know, among a regime that is driving for a deliverable nuclear weapon carried on the tips of intercontinental ballistic missiles, is about the most threatening thing I can think of. And unless we understand that that's how they think, and that they are willing to die, fi sabilillah, in the way of Allah, God. Allah means God in Arabic. Fi sabilillah, to die in his way, they are not a death cult, except for us. For break the cross and kill the pig, they're a death cult. But for themselves, they're a cult of immortality. They believe that not only would they be contributing to the immortality of Islam on earth, they believe that they themselves individually will win eternity in paradise with God by doing all of these things and obeying the commandments of Islam and of the 12th Imam in Shiite Islam.
Yeah, how do you integrate that with any society?
Yeah, right.
You know, you don't.
That's not an optional belief system. It isn't like here, where if you don't want to be, you know, Lutheran, don't go to the Lutheran church. I mean, it's not an optional belief system. You either believe it and participate in making that all happen, or you shut up. Are those the choices?
Yeah, I mean, that's it. Although, as we talked about earlier in the show today, many, many Iranians, especially among the younger, large cohort of young people in Iran, they simply don't believe, they don't follow, they're not obedient to the commandments of Shiite Islam, much less to the eschatology of the 12th Imam. You know, you don't go around trumpeting those beliefs out loud or too loudly if you you want to, you know, spend any more time here on Earth.
How does it work over there? Are you conscripted into the military? Is it an age thing? Do you join? Is that back to the point of the sword again?
The Artesh, as we said before, the ones that I hope some units will defect, is the conscript army. Yes, they're conscripted.
Okay.
Drafted to that army. That's the regular army. But after Khomeini led the revolution back in 79 and overthrew the Shah, he knew that a conscript army might not necessarily always be 100% loyal to the regime that forces them into military service, which they don't want to do. So that's when he, Khomeini, established the IRGC, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And as you can see from the name of the title of the group themselves, Revolutionary Guard Corps. They are the guardians of the revolution. And if you go to the Iranian Constitution, which is in English online, it's not hard to find, you will see that there is a section in the preamble of that constitution which is headed by the words, the ideological or an ideological army. That's the IRGC. And it quotes directly from the Quran, from verse 860, specifically of the Quran, which says, strike terror into the hearts of the enemy. Gather your forces. Make ready your forces, including steeds of war, to the utmost of your ability to strike terror into the hearts of the enemy. That's the job of the IRGC, and it's the job of the IRGC to keep the regime in power, defend it, and to spread, this is also in the Constitution, the preamble, to spread that revolution, and that's the purpose of the proxy groups, Hamas, Hezbollah, Houthis, and so forth, spread that revolution, the Islamic revolution. It's not Islamist, this isn't Islamism, this is Islamic Republic of Iran. Spread that elsewhere around the world.
There's just no room for dissent. There's no room for bargaining.
This is not government by consent of the governed, or you know, individual liberty, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of the press, those sorts of things. Freedom of religion. No, that's not part of it. That's not part of Islam.
Mm-mm.
Those are anathema to Islam, which is why they want to destroy us of Western civilization and the free world, because we believe in those principles.
And how do they square that with the rest of Islam? I mean, you have these other groups that aren't as radical.
They're not radical. They're disobedient.
Oh, okay.
They are disobeying. They are disobeying the commandments of
Islam.
In other words, many Christians, for example, you know, they may not go to church when they're supposed to every Sunday. Jews eat pork, Mary outside of the faith, that sort of thing. Every faith has those who are nominally of that faith,
mm-hmm.
but really don't obey the commandments. And that's what you're talking about. You're talking about Muslims, who may actually be very good people, and everyone should be, you know, dealt with on an individual basis, not lumped together until you know who they are. But if they are claiming to be Muslim, which, by the way, the Arabic word Muslim means one who submits to Sharia, one who submits to Islam. That's what the word actually means in Arabic, one who submits to Sharia. Now, if you don't, you can still call yourself whatever you want, I suppose, and maybe in some places that's the safer bet, but that doesn't mean that you're devout or faithful or obedient to Islam, to Sharia, much less to the eschatology of the 12th Imam. So there are loads of people who may very well be raised in a family that calls themselves Muslim. But they're not obedient, they're lax, they're disobedient, they're fallen away, they're cafeteria style, whatever you want to call them. But they're not radical. I mean, the ones who obey are not radical or extreme. They're mainstream. That's what mainstream Islam is.
It's just radical. It's radical to us.
No, not at all.
No, I mean, it looks radical to us because we don't know the rules.
No, because we're Christian or Jewish or something else. But if we talked about Christians and said, if you go to church on Sunday when you're supposed to and keep the holy days, and if you try to obey the Ten Commandments, you're a Christianist radical extremist. Well, certain committees in Congress might say that.
I was going to say, we did have a little problem with that there for a while.
Most of us would not call that Christianist or extremist. We would call that, those are faithful, devout Christians who do that. And the same thing for the Jewish people, you know, who try to keep the commandments of their faith as best they can. They're not Jewists. They're not radical Jewists or extremist Jewists. They're devout and they're faithful. The same thing with Muslims. If they obey their commandments faithfully, they're mainstream. That's normative. That's orthodox. That's straight up the middle. That's not radical.
talk to us about the... We've got, what, like 4 minutes or 3 minutes or something. You know, the countries that are all around them, we see them all as a, you know, as a voting block, if you will. Are these guys the ringleader of the, you know, of the rules? I mean, are these the guys that are just the tightest on all the rules? I want to say the most radical. I'm without vocabulary since I can't say that anymore. What about the neighboring countries? Are they just sort of hanging back, letting these guys take the lead? Or are they just better at doing
about,
it?
The neighboring countries, let's say in the general Middle East, not talking about Muslim countries like, you know, Malaysia or Indonesia way out in East Asia. I'm talking about, you know, the heartland of the Middle East, maybe across North Africa, but in particular the Middle East, right? And in particular there, those countries of the GCC, Gulf Cooperation Council, and that would be Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Bahrain, Kuwait, and so forth. These are Sunnis, majority Sunni. Now, the majority population of Bahrain is Shiite, but the regime is Sunni. But Sunni, they see the biggest threat to themselves as coming not just from the Muslim Brotherhood, that's internal, and they fight them hammer and tongs, but Iran. The Shiites, the crazy Persian Shiites who want to seize back the two holy places that they would call them in Arabia, Mecca and Medina, take them away from the administration of Riyadh, their goal to conquer those, they see them as their biggest threat. And that's why you saw certainly at least the Emirates and Bahrain be among the first signatories to the Abraham Accords. And why it is widely expected now, or hoped anyway, that Saudi Arabia, which clearly supported and was behind the Abraham Accords in President Trump's first term, that Saudi Arabia may join the Abraham Accords in a formal way in upcoming months. And so these are countries that are also under current leadership, at least. I will say under current leadership. MBS, Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Zayed in the Emirates, they are more practical and pragmatic about their countries and their country's futures than they are dogmatic. It doesn't mean that they have, you know, actually fallen away from Islam, no, but they're very willing to tinker at the edges of social mores like men and women together in cafes or theaters or sports arenas, that sort of thing. Women driving, holding professional positions in the business world. All that's happening because they, these countries, know that their future lies in a technological advancement in the 21st century. And that's not going to happen, you know, if the cameras are all on Chop Chop Square every Friday afternoon after Juniper.
Yeah, that is a downside.
They need the assistance of foreign investment to move away from strictly extractive industry, meaning oil and gas, and into other technological areas, you know, computers and AI and agricultural technology, medical technology, all of that, which Israel can help them with, is no enemy.
If they can work with them. Claire, I hate to do this.
Yeah.
Told you this would happen. We're out of time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Always out of time. We could talk to you for days. Next time, we'll schedule it for days. How's that? I know you're going to struggle against it, but, you know, it's just a thing. Our guest has been Claire Lopez. Thank you so much, Claire. We'll have the archive up right away. You're listening to
Thank
We the People.
Bomb, 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 Iran. Bomb, 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 Iran. Some rocks, tell the Ayatollah, gonna put you in a box. Bomb Iran, bomb, 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 old Uncle Sam's getting pretty hot. Time to turn Iran into a parking lot. Bomb Iran, bomb, bomb. Call the bombardiers, call the financiers, better get around.